This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
In the words of the Chinese saying, we're cursed to live in interesting times. A moment when the risks of global conflict, largely frozen for half a century, seem greater than in most of our lifetimes. To assess these risks, the Briefing Room is broadcasting a series of programmes examining three of the most likely arenas of conflict and asking, what are the chances of a conflagration in each? In the last couple of weeks, we've focused on growing tensions in the Middle East and the South China Sea. This week, Russia. It's 2.5 years since Putin's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. As of now, Russians are fighting inside Ukraine using Chinese and North Korean weaponry, and Ukrainians are fighting inside Russia using the latest American and European war tech. With so many NATO countries bordering on Russia and Ukraine, the risks of escalation have always been present. So, if such an escalation were to happen, what form might it take, and what would be the most likely consequences? Step inside the Briefing Room and together we'll find out. First, some geography and history. Natia Saskuria is founder and executive director of the Regional Institute for Security Studies, RISS, a Tbilisi-based think tank. Natia Saskuria, Russia, as any school child knows, is the world's biggest country by area, which means it has a lot of countries on its borders. Can you remind us of the countries that border on Russia? And then we can look at the ones which may be at particular risk.
Russia, as you mentioned, as the largest country in the world, is stretching over two continents, Europe and Asia. The bordering countries of Russia are 14 sovereign nations, and these are Poland and Lithuania, both bordering Russia via Kaliningrad Oblast. Also, Finland, Norway, Estonia, Latvia, Belarus, Ukraine, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, China, and Mongolia, as well as North Korea. Obviously, these are very different countries in terms of their nature. Some of them are democracies, NATO member countries, others are more authoritarian countries. But from Eastern European countries to Caucasus to Central Asia and Asia, Russia is bordering all of these very different sovereign nations. And they obviously have very distinct relationship with Russia. Some of them perceive Russia as a number one threat, and others such as China or North Korea have a very much friendly relationship with Russia.
How many of these countries and which ones are members of NATO?
Poland, Lithuania, Finland, the newest member of NATO, Estonia, Latvia are members of NATO. And we have also Ukraine and Georgia, which are aspiring to become members of NATO.
Now, which countries should we regard as being the most vulnerable to Russian incursion, should such an incursion take place?
Well, obviously, Ukraine has been most vulnerable. Before then, there was Georgia. This is a forgotten war, which happened in 2008. And because it was a very short incursion that lasted only for 5 days in terms of Russia's military involvement invasion. But I would say that Georgia is still very, very vulnerable to Russian threat due to Russian malign influence as well as active measures in Georgia.
Does Russia still hold any Georgian territory from that?
Yes, 20% of Georgian territories are occupied by Russia currently. These are Abkhazia and the so-called South Ossetia, the Tsrin Valley region. And Russia has occupied these territories as a result of the 2008 war. But even before, in early 90s, when Georgia became independent country after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Russia has been fueling ethnic tensions in Abkhazia. And as of today, Russia has two fully operational military bases on the Georgian territory in these regions. And even more so, Russia is conducting its policy of borderization, which is a least known term internationally. But by borderization, we mean the creeping occupation of Georgia, which involves installing fences and barbed wires and expanding the occupied territory of Georgia.
So it's a bit like the bad neighbor who grabs your bits of your garden by gradually moving their fences.
Absolutely. There have been families, actually, that suddenly have woken up into a new reality, being surrounded by the occupying forces.
Now, Natia, one country you didn't mention as bordering on Russia, because presumably it doesn't, but which people think nevertheless is under threat, is Moldova. Can you just briefly explain that one to us?
Moldova's territory, Transnistria, has been also subjected to Russian pressure, and the Russian forces are still present in Transnistria. And obviously, Russia tries its best to undermine the domestic political situation in Moldova. And I think what we should be really looking at right now is the elections coming up in Moldova in October 2024. Russian interference has already been one of the major issues in Moldova. And since the country is now run by pro-EU, pro-Western leadership, Russians are very much trying to use all of its measures. This is disinformation as well as economic tools to infiltrate the country and to reverse the foreign policy of Moldova, which has been particularly pro-Western and pro-EU.
One of the things I was wondering was whether membership of NATO makes some countries around Russia feel safer than if they weren't members of NATO. I'm thinking particularly about small countries like the Baltic states.
Absolutely. Putin actually never crossed the NATO Article 5 red line because, as we know, NATO Article 5 commits each NATO member to consider an armed attack against one member state as an armed attack against the whole of NATO. It gives the most powerful deterrence towards the Russian threat. Even though there have been a number of threats, the most recently when Finland and Sweden joined NATO, Russia has also threatened to use military measures and other tough measures against the will of these nations to join NATO. However, despite these escalatory narrative and despite these threats, we have never seen Putin actually test the NATO Article 5, which still remains one of the best mechanisms of self-defense against the aggressor neighboring country, in this case, Russia. And I think that's the reason why Ukraine and Georgia are aspiring to take the similar path that Baltic states have taken due to the increased Russian threat.
Natia Siskuria, lots of borders then, lots of risk. To assess that risk, Dr. Jack Watling, Senior Research Fellow for Land Warfare at the Royal United Services Institute, Michael Clark, Professor of Defence Studies and Specialist Advisor to the Joint Committee on the National Security Strategy, and Mark Galliotti, writer on Russian security affairs and Director of the consultancy Mayak Intelligence. Michael Clark, can we briefly discuss the Ukrainian incursion into Kursk before we get into the rest of this? Do you think it's any kind of game changer?
Not in the long run, but it's a very dramatic counterpunch in the current part of the offensive. So the Ukrainians have done something very inventive. They've given Putin something else to worry about, given the Russians a separate problem, and they've had a big political effect. Whether it's going to have the military effect that the Ukrainians assumed and I think hoped that it would have is still not clear, because the Russians don't seem to be taking big units away from where it really matters, in the Donbass. So I don't think this will be a game changer in the war. This will not win or lose the war for either of them, but it will set the terms for the winter and the situation that both of them will probably take into the spring of 2025, when things may change militarily at that stage.
Jack Watling, is that broadly how you see it?
I'd frame it slightly differently. I think that Ukraine is having to hedge against two very different lines of policy coming from the US after an election. And in one of those lines of policy, they may see much less military technical assistance from the West, which means that negotiations might be on the table. And if they enter negotiations, they don't want to be in the position where they are only having to give things up. They also want to have to force the Russians to make concessions to trade for something. And so what they've done in Kursk is they've taken a block of territory. They're now knocking down the bridges on the rivers so that it's more defensible. And I think they're going to try and hold it. Now, the challenge they have is that they're now stretching their own limited forces across even more front. And so this is militarily quite dangerous, but there's a very clear political logic to what the Ukrainians are doing.
Mark Galeotti, the way Jack Watling describes it there is this kind of hedge against Trump, the Kursk incursion. What can we say about whether or not it's had an effect within Russia?
It clearly has. I mean, even if one looks at the tenor of discussion on social media, which is an imperfect guide to how Russians are feeling, but given that this is an authoritarian regime, it's one of the best we've got, it's clear that there is not just shock, but also anger, a sense that they've been let down by Moscow. And that's why, you know, all wars are political. Very much agree with what's already been said. But I'd also add that from Putin's point of view, it's bad enough that there has been such an incursion. If this becomes a lasting Ukrainian presence upon Russian soil, then that begins to become more and more not just an embarrassment and an inconvenience politically for Putin, but potentially something that he might at least believe is an existential threat to his position.
Right. Now, Jack, one of the things that we've got here is the deployment of Western weaponry in Russian on Russian territory. Now, my broad understanding was that this constituted one of the Kremlin's red lines, or was supposed to. Does that turn out just not to be true?
Well, I think that the Kremlin has always talked about red lines and always been actually quite ambiguous about what they constitute. This is not the first time that Western equipment has been driven onto Russian soil by the Ukrainians. We had Hur launching an incursion with Max Pros and other gifted equipment last year. And also for the Russians, there is a clear limit to how far this can go. So it doesn't present a kind of existential threat as an invasion. But we have to be really careful about the fact that this creeping assumption that there is no point at which the Russians will react in a very dramatic manner is true until it's untrue. And if you push too far, you may find that the Russians feel compelled to react in a way which you hadn't anticipated. We're already seeing the Russians taking the view that they are in a conflict with NATO, essentially. We've had unconventional attempts to conduct sabotage and assassinations in Europe, not just against Russian dissidents, but against German industrialists and others. And so we are in this situation where the Russians do feel that they are under attack by the West, with Ukraine being used as a proxy, which in the long term may drive the Russians to behave in a very different way. So I think escalation is not a linear process, and it's one that we have to think about carefully. But we also shouldn't have a reflexive assumption that every move is going to lead to a sort of symmetrical retaliation.
Michael, do you read it in the same way?
Yes. I mean, the Russians believe in what we might call hyperwar. Gerasimov, the Gerasimov doctrine, he's the chief of the general staff, years ago said that you've got to compete on every front all the time. And that's what the Russians do in cyber warfare, in the manipulation of social media, in operations, intelligence operations, and as Jack said, sabotage operations in the West, as well as whatever they do on whatever front line they're working on. And in a way, we're already living with that. And I think, you know, the Russians might try to do more of it, or they might try to do something more novel, which unbalances us a bit more. In Ukraine itself, they're already doing their worst. They always say that there will be consequences, but if they had any more consequences they could deliver to Ukraine, they would deliver them. They're doing what they can in Ukraine already, and the Ukrainians are coping with it, although they're not being able to get on top of it so far. So we shouldn't be frightened of Russian reactions, but we should anticipate that the Russians see this as a long-term competition at a hyper level against all of the Western powers, but particularly the NATO powers.
Jack?
It's also very important, I think, to recognize that the Russians do not want this to escalate. They do not want to be fighting NATO directly. And so they will avoid driving escalation that is likely to lead to more engagement from the West. And that's a risk calculus that they have to take into consideration as well.
Mark, how do you see them working out that risk calculation?
Well, it does come back to this point about the fact that as far as they're concerned, the war in Ukraine is really just one front of a much wider conflict. I mean, it's quite striking that even at a time in which actually if an ordinary Russian refers to what's happening in Ukraine as war, they face the possibility of being sent to prison. But on the other hand, Putin, in his, for example, in last year's Victory Day speech, ironically enough, actually said that we are in a war. And as far as he's concerned, it is a war with the West. So to go back to the earlier point about the fact that there's Western kit being used, It's striking that actually that doesn't get a lot of play in the Russian media, in Russian official statements. It is rather this sense that precisely you cannot allow, as far as the Russians are concerned, they feel, you cannot allow their war to be confined to Ukraine. And this is why we are beginning to see this wider campaign of escalations already in terms of sabotage and subversive attacks. Because as far as they're concerned, when they look at, for example, the really quite successful Ukrainian campaign of sabotage and in some cases assassinations inside Russia, they do not seem to believe that Kyiv would have done this of its own volition. They believe that at the very least, Kyiv would have had to have got the West's approval, and quite possibly it did it at the West's behest. So there is almost this sense that actually, from their point of view, when seen through the sort of distorting lens of Putin's vision for, remember, this is a man who doesn't really believe Ukraine exists as a country, through that thing, he's just actually retaliating in kind. He is being, as he sees it, defensive in his moves. This is the problem. What we regard as escalation, he may often consider to be just simply retaliation.
Right. Now, all three of you, I imagine, talk to experts and policymakers in NATO and bordering countries. When you speak to them, what kind of escalation are they worried about, Mark?
It depends very much where they are. I mean, obviously, the countries which border onto Russia, which also tend to be the countries that have had their own experience of being under Moscow's rule, clearly are that much more concerned about direct military invasion, however unlikely it may seem to us, a safer distance away. Whereas when you look at other countries, again, it depends on where they perceive their own vulnerabilities to be. I mean, for example, in Italy, actually, and this is as sort of ties into the whole question of the sort of the more novel forms of pressure, they're currently worried about Russia's position in Libya, and the sense that if the Russians can actually establish a strong position in Libya, then they will be in a position to, in effect, turn on or turn off the taps of migrants heading across the Mediterranean into southern Italy. So I think this is actually something that is it's a nuanced picture, depending on the country in question, which, of course, puts real pressure on NATO, the European Union, and all these other kind of alliances, because precisely we are dealing with such a varied threat that it's very hard to actually come up with some kind of coherent response.
Jack, what do you hear?
Well, so I'll give you an example of the variety of threats. You know, the Russians are working very actively in Niger at the moment to have France's uranium concession removed and assigned to a Russian subsidiary company, so that they essentially not only become the main suppliers of enriched fuel to France, but then also own the uranium that France uses for its own enrichment upstream. And of course, France has most of its energy being produced through nuclear power. At the same time, we've seen a significant increase in the Russian presence in Yemen, looking to only assist the Iranians in developing more complex weapons that are being used against shipping from Yemen, but also now potentially to directly engage with the Houthis and assist them in striking international shipping. And then, of course, we've had the rather curious incident of the interconnectors, the Baltic connector between Estonia and Finland, but also then communications connectors between Sweden and Estonia being damaged subsurface. Now, it appears that that was conducted by a Chinese vessel, but it was sailing next to a Russian vessel at the time. There are a lot of questions around this. And so there's significant anxiety about attacks on infrastructure, all of which could drive up prices and, you know, directly harm a number of countries in the NATO alliance. And so Russia has quite a few ways of exerting pressure. And how you retaliate or respond or deter that sort of activity is difficult to be precise about.
Michael, is that broadly right, that actually what we shouldn't anticipate is, if there were a significant escalation, is Russian military activity on its bordering countries, possibly because actually it doesn't have sufficient military left over from the conflict in Ukraine?
Yes, so there are opportunities. I mean, the Georgian elections are in October, and they may well be followed by a lot of instability, a lot of domestic instability in Georgia because of the way they're being rigged at the moment. And they, Russians might try to manipulate that. And they can always try to manipulate the situation in Moldova, which is always very volatile and it's on a bit of a knife edge. But they would be rather conventional escalations of the instability that hinges around Ukraine at the moment. But I mean, I think what Mark and Jack were saying is absolutely right. If the Russians wanted to make a really big spectacular, to really hit the West in a fairly big way, it would probably be with a series of massive outages in some sense. But they could only probably do it once. It's generally believed by the cyber community in Britain that the Russians have got quite a lot of sleepers inside our cyber systems. And if they chose to activate them all in one go, they could create a great many outages that would have a cascading effect. Of course, they can only do it once because after the first time, the systems get changed and everything gets patched up. We don't know the real extent to which the Russians have infiltrated our cyber systems, or indeed to which we have infiltrated theirs. So it is possible that if a future Russian leadership really wanted to have a spectacular, novel effect in the West to indicate that it was prepared to escalate, and I'm not sure they would take that decision, but I think it is available to them to create a spectacular by attacking our electronic and cyber infrastructures. They have the, or believe to have the capacity to do that once in a big way.
Mark Galeotti.
That really raises the whole question of how deterrence works in this kind of non-military, non-kinetic form. Deterrence, classic deterrence, which is deterrence by punishment, depends on you being able to show your hand. I have the capacity to do this to you if you do that to me. When it comes to, for example, things like cyber, we precisely cannot demonstrate them because the moment at which you show your capability is the point at which the other side will then fix those vulnerabilities. So the real risk when it comes to deterrence is we may well have ways of striking back against Russia. Russia may well have ways of hurting us. But until, and God forbid, that actually gets used, none of us really knows what hand the other has.
Jack, well, then let's discuss that precise point. I remember, and I don't want to name drop here, but in a discussion some time ago when Tony Blair was Prime Minister, and it was a private discussion, he said if only people understood just how vulnerable infrastructure actually was to attack, but thank God they don't.
Yes, there are a lot of single points of failure in most systems. And in particular, this is quite an interesting point, the Ukrainian energy grid has taken an awful lot of punishment over the last 2 years through Russian kinetic strikes with missiles. And yet the Ukrainian system, because it was government-owned and as a legacy of the Soviet Union, had a huge amount of slack capacity for transmission in its energy grid. In the West, most of our energy grids are controlled by the market. Therefore, they prioritize efficiency. And as a result, you don't build huge amounts of additional transmission capacity in the grid than what is required. And so a lot of our systems are quite lean, quite efficient, and also quite vulnerable. And that is a consideration. There's a lot of work being done across NATO at the moment to look at resilience as a form of deterrence. How do you show that actually the adversary can't unhinge your energy system with a relatively small number of actions?
Mark Galeotti, let's think about a scenario in which actually the Russians are looking like being defeated in Ukraine. In other words, they're not going to achieve any of their objectives. It's hard to imagine how that would happen, but nevertheless, let's imagine that it does. Would that change the risk calculation of the Russians about what it was that they were prepared to do?
Well, of course, when we talk about the Russians, we're really talking about one particular man, Vladimir Putin, and the degree to which he has harnessed his political career as well as his historic legacy, something we know that he does obsess about on this war, is indeed a dangerous factor. So I think that, yes, it's hard to see the Russians going quietly if it looks like they're losing this war or going to lose this war, quite whatever winning or losing means. But the key point is this, is that they have a wide range of escalatory options that have nothing to do with us. He could, for example, mobilize a lot more men, even though that carries with it some substantial political risks and also becomes increasingly hard to know how to house them and arm them and train them and so forth. He could even, God forbid, take the route of thinking that, in fact, he could use some kind of non-strategic nuclear strike as some kind of signal to say, look, I will blow up a, you know, some random island somewhere distant from any population center, but next time I could be hitting Kyiv. The point is, I mean, all of these are in some ways Pyrrhic options. They carry with it massive risks for Russia and indeed for Putin himself. But he has them. But the point is, he can keep these apparently discreet from his wider conflict with the West. Because when it comes down to it, the sorts of catastrophic attacks he might choose to launch against the West through cyber or whatever are issues that actually have been recognized as falling within the purview of Article 5, which is the common NATO agreement that an attack on one is an attack on all. Now, it's also very difficult to know quite how would we respond. Would we be sending cruise missiles in response to a cyber attack? I mean, that would be a very, very difficult political question. But the point is, I think there is still quite a substantial deterrent element in terms of moves against the West for anything of that kind of scale.
Michael Clark, the thrust of my questions have all really been about Russia's willingness to escalate or being pushed into a situation where it feels it needs to escalate. But of course, there's another scenario which one can imagine, which is that Ukraine is in real danger, and at which point the West decides it needs somehow to increase the pressure on Russia, probably militarily, I would guess, in order to stop that from happening. How might that take place, or would it take place?
Well, whether or not it would take place is obviously a political question, and that will depend on the outcome partly of the American elections and the trend in European politics into next year. In theory, could it take place? Yes, it could. If the Western world decided that the effective defeat of Ukraine was so serious, was so bad for the West and bad for world order, and I think it would be personally, but if politicians in the West felt that, they could get more involved by, let's say, operating a no-fly zone over Ukrainian territory, which would prevent Russian aircraft from operating. They could give more direct help or become more directly involved in evening up the disparity in the air war. That would be a very dangerous thing to do, but we're talking here about escalation. They could do more in the Black Sea if they chose to. Whether or not the Western world would stay united to do this is an interesting point. And most analysts have said, we want to help Ukraine enough that that doesn't become the problem, that we're not drawn to have to make those decisions. And the time to avoid making those decisions sometime in the middle of next year is now. And a lot of Western politicians agree with that. They nod sagely and then they go off and don't do it.
Jack Watling, what do you think about that?
Well, if Ukraine is in a situation where it is on the cusp of defeat, then there is the question of whether NATO forces would start to try and stabilize the situation, which would probably mean boots on the ground in Ukraine. But I think we also, if we're talking about escalation, have to look at not immediate escalation, but escalation over time and escalation risk over time. There is another scenario in which the Russians essentially force Kyiv into a negotiated outcome of some kind, which is very favorable for the Russians. They therefore stop taking losses and casualties and start regenerating their forces. And at that point, in a couple of years, the Russians will be militarily very strong, but also still probably have, and certainly Putin will still have, the view that the West has done massive damage to Russia and it has hostile intent towards Russia. And at that point, the threat to nations on Russia's borders becomes a much more open question. And so, especially if there's concurrency and threats between an escalation in over Taiwan, let's say, that draws US capacity into the Indo-Pacific in combination with a Russian threat in Europe. And so actually the risks of escalation for NATO, I think, become much more tangible after Russian operations conclude in Ukraine, irrespective of how that turns out, than while the Russian army is on the ground in Ukraine and fighting the Ukrainians.
Right. All of you have reminded us that quite a lot of this is contingent, a lot of it is contingent upon political decisions. Again, you've all three of you been in touch with policymakers in Europe and in America. What is your understanding of their determination or lack of determination to face off the worst of these threats? Mark?
Again, I think it depends dramatically where you happen to be standing. If one, let's say, looks at what the Poles are doing, I mean, Warsaw has been putting a lot of resources into its military. They bought up 1,000 new tanks, which frankly only has one purpose. That is for a mass land industrial war, which essentially would mean a potential war with Russia. These are not forces that can be deployed easily to distant battlefields in the Middle East or anything like that. So, you know, some countries are actually being very serious about not just signaling their determination, but also actually building the capacities needed, because you can't just order these off Amazon and have them delivered next week on tomorrow on Prime. Elsewhere, let's be perfectly honest, one gets a lot of rhetoric, but little relative action. Point of the matter is, and in some ways, this is precisely Putin's calculation. He regards us as an astonishingly powerful alliance, but also a very weak alliance, precisely because we're a constellation of democracies. And then therefore, he thinks that we tend to get easily distracted and find it very difficult to take tough decisions. Very few politicians in the West these days could not find alternative uses for money, whether it's in terms of for tax cuts or for building up public services or whatever else. The notion that we should be spending a lot more on either the defense of Ukraine, but also in parallel with that, building up our own defense industries to the necessary level, as well as building up our national militaries, that's all something that, again, everyone agrees with to a degree in principle. But when it comes to the actual policies, when it comes to the budgets, I'm not really seeing it.
Right. Jack, let's talk about America now, because obviously a large amount of the money, a large amount of the equipment comes from America. We have the election in November. Is it the view in Europe and in bordering countries to Russia that the election is absolutely critical to what happens subsequently? In other words, it will make the biggest of differences who is actually elected.
It is generally perceived as very, very critical to the outcome insofar as the Trump campaign has articulated a policy which would force Ukraine to the negotiating table and actually extend certain conditionality on things like Article 5, potentially, to other NATO members. So there are some fundamental questions for the security of Europe that would arise from the policies that have been suggested from the Trump campaign. However, I think people overestimate the extent to which the US will remain militarily committed even under a Harris administration. And the reason I highlight that is that the US has a growing gap in its capabilities in core areas in relation to the People's Republic of China. And the threat from the PRC against Taiwan is becoming an acute one. And so more and more US capacity over the next few years is going to have to shift into the Indo-Pacific. And the pitch from the Democratic side as well in the US to European partners is, look, this is the biggest security crisis facing Europe since the Second World War. This is on you to bear the burden of that. And some countries in Europe, Mark mentioned Poland, have responded to that. Others have responded rhetorically, and I'd put the UK in this category, but have not responded in terms of making the industrial investments at the scale necessary to make our own defense sustainable. And so the US is still the primary supplier of arms to Ukraine, which means that actually I think that the idea that there's huge uncertainty here is something that people use because they want to believe that it will be, you know, continuation under a Harris administration. But actually, there are some fundamental messages coming from the US that are bipartisan about what Europe needs to do.
Michael, is that the way you see it?
Yes. I think as far as European security is concerned, we have passed, as it were, peak America in relation to the Ukraine crisis. America's commitment to Ukraine will be diminishing from here on. The Europeans will have to do a great deal more. The difference between a Republican and a Democratic administration next year is the speed with which that transition happens. In a Democratic administration, it will be a more gentle glide path, I think. In a Republican administration, it might be a bit more abrupt. But the fact is, both Ukraine and European security will have to get on in the future with considerably less American commitment. We are past the peak, even though that peak was pretty high and remarkably high in 2022, to a degree that surprised many of us. But we shouldn't settle back on that. We're back to the older historical trends where the United States will be less concerned with European security, won't ignore it, but less concerned and far more concerned with security in the Asia Pacific.
My thanks to Michael Clark, Mark Galliotti and Jack Watling. And that's it for this rather scary mini-series on the biggest threats to world peace. But I can't stress enough, The programmes weren't predictions, just possibilities. We'll be back next week at our regular time of 4 p.m. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirsty Knight and Drew Hindman. The editor was Richard Varden, and the sound engineers were James Beard and Nigel Appleton. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
If you look through your makeup bag, you might have a blusher, eyeshadow or face powder that contains the ingredient talc. But there are questions about its safety. Women diagnosed with cancer have launched court cases against cosmetics companies. They claim there's something lurking in the talc. Asbestos. I'm Phoebe Keane, and from BBC Radio 4, listen to How They Made Us Doubt Everything, Series 2, Talc Tales, on BBC Sounds.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.